Hello, and welcome to the Bitcoin Roundup podcast presented by Coinbits. We bring Bitcoin news, hot topics of conversation, and deep dives into a variety of Bitcoin topics to you weekly. We are Coinbits, a Bitcoin financial services company. Check us out at coinbits.app. This recording is for informational purposes only. No investment or legal or any other advice should be drawn from this content. And as always, consult an advisor before making any legal or financial decisions.
All right, let's get started here. People usually trickle in, Dan, over time as we get going. We are recording the space. We do release the recording as a podcast. So people who are listening to this later, hello, welcome. We are Coinbits. We are a Bitcoin financial services company. We've been around since 2018, helping people buy Bitcoin in a way that is safe and secure and self-custodied. We allow you to round up your spare change into Bitcoin, making it very easy to get off zero and get your first Bitcoin. You can set up saving habits to meet your long-term goals with Bitcoin. We are coming out with a Bitcoin IRA, and this is wonderful for people who have scattered 401ks or IRA accounts that are in fiat that they would rather put into Bitcoin. They're able to roll that in without a taxable event occurring, and then you're able to kind of grow your Bitcoin purchasing power over time and reducing your tax burden. So that's really exciting. It's coming out just in a few weeks now. If you're interested in Coinbits IRA, I highly recommend you go to coinbits.app/IRA and join the waitlist. The waitlist will allow you to move up in line if you share that link to coinbits.app/IRA. You have an affiliate link there. If you share that link, you will move up in line so that you will be one of the first people to get the Coinbits IRA feature. We are releasing it kind of in stages. So if you don't make it into that first stage and that first phase of rollout, that's okay. We will get back to you later. But if you do want it soon, go ahead and sign up. Coinbits is a Bitcoin financial services company, but we do not give financial advice. You need to talk to a certified, licensed financial advisor if you want to know whether Bitcoin is for you. We can't tell you that. We can tell you, though, that Bitcoin has certain properties that make it an extremely attractive asset as compared to other assets. So we'll be talking about Bitcoin, but not about whether you should get it. And today we have Dan Ashmore. Dan Ashmore is a writer and journalist and podcast host. He is the host of the Invez podcast. We recently had a great conversation about Bitcoin product development and emerging technology, and we thought we should bring him on. He is the author of a book called Bitcoin Money and Human Beings that just came out a couple of months ago. That's available on Amazon and other outlets. So we're going to be talking about Dan's travels, his experience writing that book, what it's about, and just general Bitcoin. And also, Dan, David and I were talking this morning, we do want to talk to you about ordinals and block space and so on, the current debate going on in the Bitcoin community about all that. So without further ado, David, why don't you take it away and start the conversation for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Dave. I guess Dave kind of gave an overview of your background, a bit of an overview already, Dan, but why don't you just tell us briefly, you know, how you got into Bitcoin, how that led you to your current career path, and just kind of a general overview of all of that.
Yeah, how you doing, guys? Thanks for having me on. So, my name's Dan. I work for Invez, the personal finance and investment website. Originally, bends across asset class, but Bitcoin is the prime focus and, yeah, probably my biggest passion area. And like you guys said, yeah, that's, I wrote a book in the area. So it kind of has always taken my eye. I got into it probably most people through Fluke back in 2016 or 2017. I just happened to sit beside a guy. I think he was in computer science or something in an old job, and he was like, hey, it'll have a look at this Bitcoin thing, and then kind of intrigued me and kept an eye on it. Like, bought a little bit, kind of tracked it, number go up, number go down, but it was only really like probably after the bear market crash in was it Christmas of 2017 that I started like getting more into it. And then during COVID was really when the passion kind of properly deepened. So I was working in TradFi at the time, like investment analyst, I guess. Like I grew up in Dublin, but it was probably like the Irish equivalent of a Wall Street job, if you want to put it that way. But yeah, I just decided to convert over. Got offered the chance to, I guess, make the jump across, and went kind of remote too. So started traveling around a bit, which is where the book came. I kind of, threaded like my travel stories through my thoughts on Bitcoin a little bit. So I just like sat down and was like, okay, let's just write a whole analysis on it and build a model on this thing, and kind of started out as a paper and then turned into a book. But it was just a fun side project. But that's kind of my quick background, I guess.
That's awesome, man. And so you have this TradFi background in analysis, and now you really focus on kind of content creation. Can you talk a little bit about how that transition went for you?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny little transition. So I guess I'm sort of like half research, half journalism, I guess, but definitely using the creative side of my brain a lot more, which is different. Like I remember I used to blog a little bit on the side, and especially during COVID, about Bitcoin. And, you know, I've always been passionate about macroeconomics. So that's kind of like the angle I like to take with Bitcoin, is analyzing it through a macroeconomic framework. It was definitely a little bit of a change, activating that creative side more. And it's quite rewarding too, and it can be a lot more stimulating too. So I used to kind of just sit in models all day, which I really do love, to be honest, as nerdy as it is. I kind of like pulling up a spreadsheet and just digging into the numbers. And I still like do that a lot in the content I make. Like it's often like model based, and I'm like plotting correlations and kind of like analyzing it from a numerical point of view. But yeah, it's also fun on the creative side too. And the podcast obviously is not numerical at all, and a whole new avenue. But it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, one question that comes to mind, Dan, is do you ever keep in touch with your TradFi friends, you know, especially about Bitcoin? Because one thing I've noticed is that, you know, there's a huge information asymmetry that's like still there. Like I was talking to one of my good friends who works in TradFi, just like high yield credit sales at a Wall Street bank. And, you know, he was very curious about Bitcoin, but still very, very much like, okay, what's a consensus mechanism? What's proof of work? Like, what's this halving thing, right? So I'm wondering, like, you know, do you have those conversations with the people from your former job? Are they curious? What's kind of like the overall sentiment?
Yeah, they're definitely curious. Honestly, they're a lot less curious now with the price no longer 65K or whatever it was. During the massive bull run during COVID, like it was all I was being asked. I was like kind of known as the Bitcoin guy amongst my friends, and it was this big exciting thing. And now it's almost worn like a curse now that the price has come down a bit. But they're still interested. Like that's kind of what inspired me to write the book a little bit. I was like, you know, Bitcoin's this huge asset, but it really isn't on a grand scale. Like when you're comparing it to legacy asset classes, you're looking at how big equities are, you know, the fixed income markets. Like Bitcoin's just a drop in the ocean, and a lot of people they're super curious about it and they don't really know about it. And then the tech side is I think the tech side can be quite intimidating as well, which was part of the reason I wanted to write about it. Like the concept of blockchain to an uninitiated mind is even to people like within crypto, I think a lot don't like properly understand the Bitcoin white paper and kind of the beauty and how new this breakthrough is, you know, the double spend problem and all that. So I was like, okay, I'll just like sit down and try break it down as easy as possible in simple terms, but while also hoping to kind of add value to people who are into it. And then I kind of got more into analyzing it as like an investment and like comparing it to money and seeing like where could it go. But yeah, a lot of it was kind of motivated by, you know, friends in TradFi and people who kind of had an eye on financial markets and were into it, but didn't really know about Bitcoin. They kind of thought it was this like, you know, magical internet money, for lack of a better expression, that just kind of number go up, number go down, when there really is a lot to analyze and talk about it underneath the hood. So yeah, very much so. But I think it's, I guess it's natural, but the interest has definitely come down a lot in line with the price. And but then in the last few months, when the price kind of bounces back up again, suddenly people are super interested in it. So I mean, it's human nature, I think. But yeah, it's kind of funny.
Yeah, that's of course, we're all familiar with how it's easier to sell Bitcoin when it costs more, which is really a little bizarre, but totally understandable from a psychological standpoint. But you mentioned that part of what inspired you to write the book was these interactions. Can you talk a little bit more about the kind of the motivation behind the book and what its central thesis is and kind of how that all works?
Yeah, sure. So the book wasn't meant to be a book at the start. Like I wrote a paper. I don't know if anyone's familiar with Greg Foss's paper, where he looks at, so Greg was, he's kind of a veteran of the credit markets, and he analyzes bonds and looks at like yields and kind of tries to compare how he looks at maybe like using Bitcoin as a hedge against the whole credit system. So he mentioned this thing called Fulcrum Index, and I read the paper and I was kind of fascinated by it, and I'm like a bit of a numbers nerd. So I dropped him a DM and I was like, hey, Greg, can you tell me like a little bit more about how you worked the numbers behind these? He put a fair value. He kind of put a fair value on Bitcoin. I can't remember what it was. I don't even want to say it, but it was a bullish number. And I was kind of intrigued about how he got there, because he didn't really go into it that much in the paper, like the kind of numbers under the hood. So I dropped him a DM and he was like, hey, Dan, yeah, no one's actually asked me about how I worked it out before. So we jumped on a call anyway, and I was kind of like excited about it. And then I looked into it a bit more and kind of strapped my own analysis on top and like sort of like compared it to the gold markup. And anyway, I ended up building this like this model to forecast like what the fair value of Bitcoin could be, as elusive a concept as that is. And it ended up being like, you know, I don't know what it was. It was like 15,000-20,000 words. So I was like, I totally did it for fun on the side. And I was like, okay, well, why not just like turn this into a book? Cause I actually have loads more to say. So I just kind of purely wrote about it on the side. I've never written a book before. I don't know what it entails. So I was just kind of bashing keys on a laptop for the most part. And then I kind of gave a little intro about myself and crossing over. And like, I grew up in Ireland. We had one of the worst banking crises in history in 08. Like our country went bankrupt, essentially. We had to get bailed out by the IMF. So I layered that in and kind of looked at that. And I was like, you know, could Bitcoin kind of maybe present a solution to these problems? Like a lot of people talk about it, but what could this world actually look at? And, you know, at this point I was in Colombia as well, traveling to South America. So I was living in the developing world, and I was like, which has implications as well. And you see, you know, these devaluing currencies, like I think the Colombian peso has lost like 98% of its value over the last 60 years compared to the dollar. And then like the Argentinian stories are quite familiar in Bitcoin circles. So yeah, I was kind of layering all these elements in and just building out this book just for fun, really. I never kind of did it to make money. Like it's not, it's quite a niche topic, and I'm not like a big name, so I knew it was never going to sell. It was just purely for fun. And yeah, then I went to El Salvador and was interviewing people there about what they thought about, you know, being legal tender. And yeah, it just kind of turned into this big like financial model, like predicting what the value of Bitcoin would be and comparing it to money and kind of asking the question, is it just a speculative gamble or is there more to this thing? But yeah, that's it in a nutshell, I suppose.
So it's an interesting title, though, Bitcoin, Money, and Human Beings. You bring in this kind of like this human, almost emotional element there. Can you talk about like what? How does the title relate to the content? How did you come about that?
Yeah, sure. So it's like it's in three parts. The first is like an intro to Bitcoin, and it explains what it is and explains my background growing up, you know, through that bank crisis in Ireland that I mentioned. And then the middle part compares it to money, which is where the money element comes in. So it looks at, you know, things like 1971, when the US abolished the gold standard, and it looks like the devaluation of the dollar since then, and, you know, different economic consequences out of that. You know, it looks at real incomes and kind of housing compared to wages, and how wealthy people are in real terms since then. And it looks at, you know, then obviously the big money printing came through COVID. So I, as I wrote this, kind of inflation was starting to become a thing, and all these things were happening. So it kind of got a little bit lucky in terms of what was happening earlier, and I was kind of like comparing it to that. And then I was talking a bit about, you know, being in Colombia and threading in these stories about these developing nations and their currencies. And so that's where the money came in. And then, yeah, the human side at the end of the day, I was like looking at it as an asset and looking at how it moves and saying, okay, it's crazy volatile. I was like comparing it to gold and euro, and I was like, there's still so much emotion in this thing. It is still, you know, humans are kind of driving the price of this thing right now. And I was kind of like comparing that to what could happen in the long term, you know, if the fundamentals would kind of come through, or what it could be one day. And yeah, that's kind of where the humans are. Like, it's sort of half about human history and its relation and human's relationship with money, and then half about like what Bitcoin is and could it actually do anything. So I just kind of decided to call it that title to kind of convey that it wasn't just a Bitcoin book. Like, I'm not just talking about blockchain the whole way through. I'm kind of talking about money and how, you know, right from the invention of paper money all the way through to today and what's happened. And, you know, like, I was in, another coincidence, I was in Ecuador for a few weeks, and there was like these massive inflation or protests against inflation and like what it was doing to the country. And, you know, they were terrible. It was like 5 or 6 people died in them, and it was kind of scary. But then I kind of threaded that in, and I was like, yeah, it's a very human story at the end of the day, because money's been invented by humans. It's not a tangible thing. You know, we all just sit around and kind of agree that it has value. So yeah, that's kind of where the title came from, I guess.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, talking about explaining money and, you know, how money and banking works is just so important and really undertaught, or I guess undertaught well. Definitely in the United States. I'm very interested in your fair value model. I'm wondering if you could kind of explain the framework about how you, like, you know, put that together. What's like the framework for the overall model?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'll try to summarize it as best I can without talking for too long. So I took a number of scenarios, and I come to a number at the end of it. I'm almost hesitant to say it, because it's more about the conclusion out of the model was more that, you know, this is an asymmetric asset with like huge upside and like limited downside. And it's very hard to put a fair value on it, because it's so hard to know what will happen in the future, because you're talking about like massive ticket items, like literally, you know, the path of civilization and our view on money, and like massive like geopolitical events and all these things. So I took a number of scenarios and approached it from an expected value point of view. So I forecast like what the price of Bitcoin would be in a number of scenarios, and then I put a probability on those scenarios occurring. And then out of that backed out like a simple expected value calc. Now, so some of the scenarios looked at were a little more complex. Like one I hinted earlier, it was kind of inspired by Greg Foss's view on it. And I took like all the sovereign debt in the world. So like, you know, the way the US has like $30 trillion of debt, and I looked at like maybe if you could use Bitcoin as a hedge against this as insurance, and looked at it like from a CDS spread point of view. So the same CDS bonds that were used in, you know, popularized in the Big Short movie, that were used to hedge against the kind of banking collapse in 08. I was like, maybe you can sub Bitcoin in, because what happens if, you know, the debt crisis gets out of hand and it collapses, like what does that do to Bitcoin? And so I kind of replaced them with insurance as these insurance items and CDS debt kind of thing. So I was like, yeah, what happens if I count up all the debt and multiply that debt by these spreads, and like what price does Bitcoin come at that point? And like, obviously these are like, this is an extreme scenario of literally like the debt bubble getting, it's pretty topical now with the debt ceiling conversation going on this week. But if like defaults ever do happen and debt gets out of control, like what price would Bitcoin be in that scenario? And like, I think I only assigned this like a 1% chance to show that like, yeah, it to kind of highlight the asymmetry of Bitcoin. Because I was like, even if there's a 1% chance of that, and if I put that in an expected value model, like I'm not, my whole point here is like that Bitcoin's incredibly volatile and dangerous. I'm not, it's dangerous from like a short-term investing point of view. And I don't like people, say like Michael Saylor, obviously huge Bitcoin believer, but he kind of overlooks the portfolio management side of things. Like, it's not very practical to tell someone to mortgage their house to buy any asset in the world, regardless of your beliefs on it. Like, Bitcoin could go to $2 million tomorrow, and I'd still think that, you know, a billionaire kind of advising people to mortgage their house and put like at risk their ability to put food on the table next week just to buy Bitcoin or buy any asset, I'd still think that's kind of irresponsible, depending on, regardless of what happens, that asset, in this case, Bitcoin. So yeah, I kind of looked at it like, took this massive like fair value point of view and like looked at what could Bitcoin be in all these scenarios. And then I also put in a scenario, if it does go to zero, and kind of highlighted that you can still see this thing go to zero, and you can still, the fair value is still pretty high. And I was like, this kind of highlights the asymmetry. Like, even if you think there's a chance to go to zero, like the potential upside here is so huge. And then looked into the ramifications that has for, you know, investing in it as part of a portfolio. So it's not taken from the point of view of like pouring your entire net worth into this asset, or, you know, making these massive bets with all your paycheck and leaving nothing left for you to live your daily life with. It's kind of taken from a very, old fashioned portfolio point of view, and like responsible asset allocation and stuff, and being like, if you fit this thing into a portfolio, what argument is there to invest in it? And what value do you think it could have? So I guess that's kind of the thesis behind it.
Okay, cool. And what's the, I know the like market, or I guess like total value of all like credit default swaps has gone down a lot since like 2008, but that's still a pretty, you know, there's like a few, there are trillions in that market, right? So that's a pretty decent monetary premium that Bitcoin could like potentially eat, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, the number on Bitcoin in that scenario is through the roof. If you do believe it's a hedge on all this debt. Like, if you look at the US alone, like I actually went to the debt clock in New York. If anyone lives in New York or has been there, you can see the debt clock. It's quite funny. I think it was like 30 trillion or something when I was there. It's probably like 32 trillion now or something. And then they've got all these like pension obligations, which aren't technically a sovereignty guarantee, but in reality they are. So, that brings it up way higher. Like the debt in the world is absolutely enormous right now. And yeah, obviously if you do think that Bitcoin can like hedge that, and then you imagine a scenario where there are defaults, then, you know, you get a value through the roof. But these are like way out on the curve. Like, I also just look at more base case scenarios, I guess. So I kind of like try to look across the whole spectrum and put them all in and kind of assign probabilities to each scenario. The thesis behind it all.
Cool. That sounds like a really powerful, or like interesting tool for people to look at, because that is like it's a really, I guess, not like understudied, but it's a something that people are still really trying to figure out, right? Like how do you value Bitcoin? Because it's not like a stock or a bond or something like that. I'm wondering, so you said there were like some base case scenarios that you came up with. Do you mind describing like some of those and how you thought about that?
Yeah, sure. And yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, regarding like there's actually very few models or very few approaches taken, because Bitcoin is such a novel asset. Like you've got the stock to flow model, which, you know, has become quite popular by Plan B. But beyond that, it's like you say, like Bitcoin doesn't pay a dividend. There's no yield. So it's hard to analyze it from a traditional valuation perspective. So that was part of the motivation that I took. When I say base case scenarios, yeah, I just mean kind of less extreme scenarios, in terms of like, I did look at, you know, debt and insuring all that, but I also looked at comparing it. So, you know, one popular method is to compare it to the market cap of gold, like see if it does become a store of value. And, you know, gold is, I know it's hit an all-time high recently, so that's probably a little bit higher than this, but I think at the time I looked, it was like 11 trillion was the market cap of gold. And then I was saying, okay, if Bitcoin matches the gold market cap, what price does that put each Bitcoin at? Because, you know, it's fascinating in that there's, what makes this so intriguing to model is that there's a fixed supply. It's not like, you know, fiat where you can print it, or it's not like even like equities where you can create more and kind of split them or whatever. It's like, so from a modeling point of view, it makes it kind of fascinating. You know exactly via this predetermined schedule that there's only going to be 21 million Bitcoin. So it makes kind of these funny scenarios where, yeah, if you're like, okay, if it does match the 11 trillion market cap of gold, what price is each Bitcoin and things like that. So, and then, yeah, I hinted at it earlier. I also looked at a scenario where, like, if you do imagine it goes to zero, and even if you put that at a high probability in the model, it still kind of kicks out a pretty lofty fair value given the asymmetry. So yeah, I like compared it to gold, and I'm trying to remember what other scenarios I had. I looked at like a bunch of different variations around debt, so some more aggressive than others, and then I looked at like if it takes like a certain percentage of the total financial assets in the world, like, and I kind of compared it to all these other asset classes like real estate and equity and fixed income, and looked at like what kind of percentage of the financial markets would have to capture to reach certain thresholds, and yeah, I just kind of then put it all in a mixer and then see what came out. But yeah, the underlying theme was always to look at this from that means for investing in it as part of a portfolio. So it kind of
Hey Dan, we have lost you. You dropped out completely and then you came back for like a second and then we lost you again.
Am I here now?
Yes, now we can hear you again.
Hello?
Now you're gone again.
Am I still gone?
You are. Now you're here. Hello. Hey.
Oh, sorry about that. I have no idea what happened to maybe my Wi-Fi dropped or something.
Dan, can you hear us?
I can hear you, Yellow.
I can hear loud and clear anyway. Maybe my Wi-Fi dropped. Sorry about that.
No worries. No, I think you're coming to the end of your point anyway about Bitcoin and allocation to portfolio and asymmetric bet. We take the same approach, and actually we have direct experience with that. So having been around since 2017 and having had people DCA into Bitcoin with their spare change since then, you know, we've seen this asymmetric bet play out when people were rounding up and they were buying tiny amounts of Bitcoin every week with their credit card, the change from their credit card purchases. You know, with the bull run in 2020 and beyond, that turned into a chunk of change for people. And so this thing that did not, it was an easy decision for them to turn on because it was not impacting their budget pretty much at all. And they wound up being able to gain some purchasing power there. And, you know, we completely agree. And I think that that's really something that as Bitcoin educators and communicators, we need to hammer on. Because there's this story that people need to understand, which is it is asymmetric. Even if you thought there were a 90% chance that it was going to zero and a 10% chance that it was going to appreciate 100 times or 1,000 times, you would still want some, right? And you don't obviously have to overallocate if you're that bearish, but you would still want some. And then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if everyone did that and had only a very small amount of Bitcoin just as a hedge in case it worked out, then in fact it would work out, right? That would support the thesis. So I find that as Bitcoin educators, I haven't nailed down that story, and Coinbits is still kind of working on formulating that argument. And I don't really hear that out in the wild. I think we could do a better job of convincing the skeptics. Yes, you're skeptical. I'm not here to convince you not to be skeptical. I'm not here even to convince you that it's not going to zero, even though obviously we don't think so. I just think that wouldn't you agree that if even there's a small chance that this would work out, that you should have some?
Yeah, I think, like you say, it kind of all ties into asset allocation and portfolio management. It's kind of why I mentioned Michael Saylor earlier. Like, that's sometimes, the external image of Bitcoin, and that it's this like very you know, almost evangelical, you know, it's all or nothing, like you have to just put everything in Bitcoin, when, you know, if you do step back and, you know, analyze it as an asset just like any other asset, and yeah, approach it from that portfolio side of things, like there's a way. And it's interesting that you mentioned DCA, like, because that's definitely a more responsible way to do it as well. Like, even the power of DCA, Bitcoin or not, like I coincidentally built a model recently. I wrote about it for Invest, and I like assumed that if you took the worst stock market investor, or the unluckiest stock market investor who just never invested in the market but entered in right at the peak, which I think was like late December 2021, and then purchased like $1,000 each month, that they'd actually be in profit now, despite, you know, 2022 being such a torrid year. And even though, like, you know, we after these last few months, we've kind of bounced back up, and it kind of shows that, you know, if you stick to a plan and kind of take emotion out of it and treat it from a portfolio side, that, you know, because, but like we were saying earlier as well, humans are emotional creatures, so it's a little bit easier said than done. But yeah, I think it's, they're important points that you raise, and definitely probably need to be emphasized more, I think, by the community. There's no point in kind of just screaming at someone to buy this or that, regardless of whether it's Bitcoin, any asset. But I think, yeah, you can be more responsible and kind of more objective and approach it from a more calculating and cold point of view. And sometimes people, that amplifies with people a little more.
Yeah, I also wonder if, like, the whole kind of, dare I say, everything bubble that the Fed had, like, built up, you know, with zero interest rate policies following, like, the global financial crisis, caused people to, like, you know, psychologically, I guess, not expect things to go down, right? And like, forget that Amazon had a 90% drawdown in 2 years following the NASDAQ bubble bursting, you know. And so, like, when Bitcoin has these, like, drawdowns, everybody's like, oh my gosh, right? Like, so I wonder if how that plays into it, just like the expectation side of it, and the, like, perspective, you know, and how you just described, like, zooming out and looking at the performance of a weekly, daily, or monthly DCA over, like, a certain time horizon.
Yeah, I think it definitely plays into it. Like, it's a super unique time in the wider economy and financial markets that we've just gone through in the past few years. You know, like you say, we've never seen this scale of money printing before. We've never seen interest rates this low for this long before, until the last year, obviously. And we've never gone through a global pandemic of this scale before, where, you know, we've got economies locked down. And so all these things, yeah, it's been a crazy few years. And that, you know, when you see the market doing what it did do, and going all the way back from 2009, like, I think the NASDAQ did like 13x from its low point in March 2009 to its peak in late 2021. So for anything that was far out in the risk spectrum, like I always like to say, like, you could, yeah, it's like monkeys throwing darts at a dartboard. Like, it would be almost an achievement to have picked something over a long time horizon between those years and not made money. Like, pretty much everything went up. So yeah, of course, that kind of messes with people's minds and puts you in a weird spot. But, you know, we've seen these drawdowns before. But what I think is interesting as well, to kind of use the opposite of what you said, when you say, you know, Bitcoin is, you pointed towards Amazon going down, and you're saying that Bitcoin has gone down this many times before. And yeah, it has, but it's also like quite unique in now that this is Bitcoin's first experience of a wider bear market. Like, it was launched in 2009. Just after the economy had come out of this, or the market had come out of this massive crash. And then, you know, we were on this relentless bull run, like we just said. So Bitcoin's actually never been around before when the markets had a prolonged period of drawback like it had last year. So it's why I think it's very interesting at the moment, because, you know, we've never seen the asset act like this before. It's never existed in this climate. Like, people kind of forget how young it is, but this is Bitcoin's first stock market recession, if I can use that expression. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great point, because I remember, you know, a lot of, like, FUD or naysayers would say, like, you know, it's the same thing as, like, a risky tech stock. So when those really, you know, like, go down a lot, right? Like, Bitcoin will do the same thing. And it's not like fully been the case, right? So I think that that's a really interesting point that you bring up.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting questions in the long term is, you know, if or when it can decouple and stop acting like a risk or a high risk asset, because like we saw hints of this with the recent banking crisis when tech stocks kind of fell a bit, the market as a whole and Bitcoin came up a bit, but it's only brief periods of decorrelation. Like if you do plot this thing, I wish I could share my screen here, but if you do plot it against you know, something like the NASDAQ, Bitcoin has tracked it extremely closely, and you know, it's kind of traded off these expectations about future interest rates, which sort of goes against the underlying fundamentals, and you know, it should be like an inflation hedge almost. So the reality is that like it is trading very much like a risk asset right now. You know, I think its correlation with the NASDAQ is now at all-time highs. Yeah, it's just it's kind of fascinating to think, and this is kind of what I focus on a lot in the book, is looking at these correlations and kind of imagining scenarios that could make them decouple, or seeing long term like when this can happen, and you know, that's when we'll really see what Bitcoin's made of. But it's, yeah, like I say, it this thing has only been around since 2009, so it's not we don't really have a long period to track this thing. So yeah, it's trading like it's super correlated right now, but yeah, this is its first market recession, and who knows what will happen in the future.
Yeah, definitely. I just because I honestly haven't looked at it. Is it correlated with gold at all? And like over long periods of time, like I guess like it is with the NASDAQ, or not so much.
Yeah, so I actually wrote a piece on this as well recently. Like we're actually in this weird juncture where gold and stocks are as correlated as they've been in a long time. So it has actually been trading in a very correlated manner. Bitcoin has been trading in a very correlated manner with gold over the last year. But we're just at a weird point where gold's almost like trading off inflation expectations in the same way that stocks are, rather than like current inflation. So it is kind of correlated to gold, but it's sort of not really, if that doesn't sound like a total contradiction. But yeah, it's just weird, like markets are just kind of oscillating at the moment, and they're all kind of in tandem. Like you see everyone's just kind of hanging on the word of Jerome Powell, and it's, you know, hints of like tapering off from hikes or cuts, and the market bounces across the board, and then, oh, you know, inflation's still high, we need to hike more, and then it does the opposite. So we're kind of at a weird juncture, and I think we're almost at a threshold moment as well. Like it does look like we're at the end of the hiking cycle, so you know, it'll be really interesting to see what the next inflation numbers are, and how both stocks and Bitcoin and gold for that matter can react. But yeah, it's definitely been like a super turbulent year, but it does feel like we're at a threshold moment, and you know, we're about to find out a lot more about the market and the wider economy. Like things overall are definitely better than you would have expected 6 months ago. Like labor's still good, you know, like the housing market hasn't showed as much softness as people have thought. So yeah, it's interesting. Like who knows what will happen. There's still a long way to go, and if you look historically at when these like rapid tightening cycles end, it's actually afterwards that the market often dips. So now obviously we don't have data for Bitcoin going back to previous cycles, but these are economic cycles, I mean not Bitcoin cycles, but yeah, we don't have that data, but yeah, it'll be really interesting to see what happens next, I think.
Cool. So I guess, you know, just because we have you here and it's coming up in roughly a year, what are your thoughts on the halving? Have to ask. I guess,
yeah,
respect to price.
Oh, that's such a tough question to answer. short-term Bitcoin, like I'm not going to pretend I have any idea like anybody else. Geez, it is only a year away. Yeah, that's really crept up quickly. It feels like 2020 was just yesterday. I have no idea, really. I think it totally depends on short-term. It's just going to depend on the state of the economy and how well, you know, we can come out of this tightening cycle. If that soft landing can be achieved, because that's going to, you know, set the tone for the financial markets across the board, and it's just so hard to picture. That's still it does feel like tomorrow, but it's still a long way away, and a lot can happen between now and then. You know, if that kind of soft landing is achieved and things are still floating along nicely, and then the halving comes in, that could be very promising for Bitcoin. But on the flip side, like, there could very easily be a pain down the road for the economy. Like, that those labor numbers might not stay up. Like, maybe inflation is a little stickier than we think. Things are a little better in the US than they are in Europe or elsewhere. But I don't know. I'm hesitant to give a short term price forecast, because I'd just be picking out a number. I'm not going to pretend like I have any clairvoyant knowledge here or anything. I'm more kind of intrigued in the long term aspect. I think short term, it's just, there's nothing harder to predict, which kind of gets back to the central point that Dave was talking about earlier and DCAing, because, you know, in the short term, it's just too hard to know.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think price talk, it's frustrating, price talk, because you're obviously going to be wrong. You're obviously going to mislead yourself and others. It doesn't matter. In fact, at Coinbits, we recently, as we've kind of evolved the way that we do our writing and our content, we really try never to say the price of Bitcoin. We try to use the word exchange rate, because we try to kind of characterize value as being based on Bitcoin first, Bitcoin becoming a universal language for communicating and transmitting value. It really doesn't make sense to think about it as a price in US dollars, even though obviously that matters. So I wanted to ask you actually about, I don't know if you have an opinion about this current event in Bitcoin regarding block space, ordinals, BRC20, and so on. I don't know if are you familiar with all the developments in that area. Do you have any opinions?
Yeah, I've sort of been following it from afar. I don't have any passionate opinions one way or another. I'm kind of surprised that these block debates are coming up again. I kind of thought they were condemned to the past. Like, it just feels like so long ago. The ones was it 2017 and the Bitcoin Cash and all that. I really thought that was kind of condemned to the past. I hadn't thought about Bitcoin Cash in a long, long time. I don't even know what it's doing at the moment. But yeah, it surprises me. The ordinals, I mean, I know there's kind of very passionate opinions on either side. Like, some people are like, oh, it goes against the very ethos of Bitcoin. And, you know, it's NFTs and BRC20 and all these crazy terms and stuff. But I mean, I think it's kind of harmless. I think it's going to, I don't think it's any value. I'd never invest in anything like that ever again. And I don't think it's really anything to do with Bitcoin or kind of what interests me about Bitcoin and looking at it like I was saying, like that macroeconomic angle and stuff, like it's really nothing to do with it. But I also think it's kind of harmless and these things are going to die down. I think the interest will drop. Like, I mean, people were saying all sorts about NFTs back in the pandemic bull run, and, you know, the volume there has disappeared. I think it will be kind of similar here, but I'm not like cheering for their demise, or I'm not like cheering them on. I think it's like, oh, that's kind of interesting, and I'll like browse by it on my timeline every now and then, but I'm not like super involved or anything, or have any strong opinions one way or another.
I think that's a safe approach. I agree with you. It's probably just going to blow over, although it is kind of a fascinating thing to see the Bitcoin community a little bit split by like a wedge issue, where people are pretty much aligned on 90% of their opinions on Bitcoin and money and economics. But there's like this one thing where, you know, you could be like a protocol maximalist, kind of, or like a freedom maximalist when it comes to using a protocol. Or you could be like, well, maybe so, but we should change the protocol. And I think what I've been noticing in the last few days is people calling to change the protocol or maybe on the back foot. And I think we're probably just going to watch this thing play out over time. Although it is, we were talking a couple days ago, it is a nice dry run for hyperbitcoinization, right? So we've all been hoping for and expecting hyperbitcoinization. Obviously, eventually we would expect that block space would be at a super premium like this. And, you know, I don't think anybody in the Bitcoin community was necessarily thinking that it would be a bad thing if widespread Bitcoin adoption suddenly went parabolic like immediately, but now we're seeing that perhaps the ecosystem has some more work to do to kind of enable it to not teeter and strain under its own weight when you do have these full blocks. So Dan, I do want to ask, and audience, if anybody wants to ask a question or submit a topic for discussion, this is, you know, very free form, casual conversation, just raise your hand and we'll give you the floor. But in the meantime, while we wait for that, Dan, do you have any like resources that you would send us to? Obviously your book, Bitcoin, Money and Human Beings, which we talked about, but anything else you want to point us to that you find especially interesting to kind of enlighten, that has enlightened you? It could be on about Bitcoin or it could be any topic really.
Let me think. Yeah, like I keep saying, like it's kind of the macroeconomic angle to Bitcoin is my kind of thing. So I like, you know, taking a looking at its valuation in a global context and like comparing it to other asset classes and seeing what's happening in the wider economy. Like, I don't just work on Bitcoin. I like analyze and build models like all across like a bunch of asset classes. So I'm constantly looking at like plotting Bitcoin against various assets and trying to see if I can come up with any patterns. I've recently been, yeah, like super interested in just, we talked about it a little bit earlier, but like tracking that correlation and how it's changing or not changing against both stocks and gold. I think that's really interesting, especially as those banking wobbles transpired. And then, you know, it's volatility as well. Like the liquidity is so low right now in Bitcoin markets. And we saw like that story that came out a couple of days ago about Jane Street and Jump Crypto. They're pulling back their market making activity as well. And, you know, it's still the Alameda hole in liquidity still has been replaced from November. Like markets are just so thin right now, which I think is exacerbating moves to both the upside and the downside, which I think is part of the reason why Bitcoin has run up so heavily this year, despite the fact that, you know, it's outperformed tech so much this year. And there really hasn't been that much good news or like ostensible explanation for it. I think it is just, you know, there's softer expectations around the future path of interest rates and just less capital is needed to move this thing right now. But yeah, that's kind of what I've been interested in recently. This week, I did a piece yesterday. I saw that, you know, the amount of addresses holding one Bitcoin or more is just about to hit 1 million. I think it's like 998,000 or something, which is interesting. But yeah, apart from that, I'm just kind of like, just tracking what's going on day to day. And yeah, just seeing if I can uncover patterns or see interesting developments and what they kind of mean for valuations going forward and ongoing prices.
Excellent. Well, we can leave it there, guys. Thank you, everybody. So Dan, we really do appreciate your time and the passion and the insight that you bring to Bitcoin. And I have not picked up the book. I'm going to go check it out, though. Really interesting that you have this fair value model. I've actually heard that term elsewhere as well. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of interesting work to be done to figure out, like, what exactly goes on with the exchange rate and why. I saw an article by a Bitcoin bear a few weeks ago, and her thesis was Bitcoin just kind of does this, meaning, you know, it's like unknowable why the price moves. It's possible. I don't know. I think there's got to be some kind of explanation for it. Also, I'm curious about eventually understanding, like, when Bitcoin does move, you know, let's say it crashes or there's like a downturn, where's the money going, right? I mean, it's a curious question. I suspect a lot of it is to consumption, actually, as opposed to another asset, but that's maybe just a working theory of mine. Anyway, Dan, thank you again for being here. We really appreciate you. Any closing remarks?
I'm always happy to hear from people if they've feedback on my pieces or my analysis or suggestions. Yeah, feel free to reach out to me on Twitter or elsewhere. But yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. I'm always happy to chat Bitcoin and markets, so it was fun.
All right, guys, thank you. We're Coinbits. We are a Bitcoin-only financial services company. We help you DCA into Bitcoin. We can buy big and small amounts. If you're looking for a larger amount of Bitcoin, we have Bitcoin Coinbits Reserve, which is for higher net worth institutions and businesses. Check that out at coinbits.app/reserve. And we are releasing a Bitcoin IRA for consumers and plebs. Go to coinbits.app/IRA, get on the waiting list, and we will be reaching out. And that's all for us. Thanks, everybody. Have a wonderful rest of your Friday and a lovely weekend. We will talk to you next week. Take care, everybody. Cheers.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Bitcoin Roundup podcast presented by Coinbits. So what do you think of the conversation? Share your thoughts with us on Twitter at Coinbits App, and be sure to subscribe to be notified of our next episode release. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Bitcoin Roundup podcast.